foundational for any understanding of Catholic bioethics concerning the beginning of life is teaching concerning the interrelationship of the unitive and procreative ends or dimensions of human sexuality. This is a teaching that has been particularly stressed in modern times, and an understanding of it is foundational for an appreciation both of the Catholic Church's teaching in regard to contraception and also in regard to new technologies concerning the beginning of life, assisted reproduction, and the Church's objection to such techniques as in vitro fertilization, stem cell research, and so forth. So in these next sections, we will be considering the development of this tradition in the 20th and beginning of the 21st centuries, which are the period during which the Church has, in a particularly vivid way, begun to reflect on and very clearly articulate doctrine concerning the sacrament of matrimony and the notion of human fertility, and its place both in Christian ethics and its significance for the broader area of bioethics as well. Connected with this will also be the Church's understanding, and this may seem slightly paradoxical, of consecrated celibacy, or consecrated virginity, or the lifelong vow to celibacy that's also associated with the sacrament of holy orders. The Catholic Church has always maintained that there is an interrelationship between the married state on the one hand and consecrated celibacy, particularly for those who are in religious vows, on the other. This has had a rather rocky history and tradition, in the sense that in the century when it first began to be articulated, the 4th century, there was a controversy called the Jovinian controversy between St. Jerome, who was never known for restraining himself in his use of polemic or invective, and Jovinian, who claimed that marriage was equal to or even superior to the state of consecrated virginity. The ultimate resolution of this controversy was a declaration which was then reiterated throughout the centuries that the state of consecrated virginity, the state of consecrated celibacy, is in some sense higher than marriage. This was understandable in light of the resolution of a heresy and a controversy, and it also makes a great deal of sense given the understanding of sexuality that existed in the ancient world, but it was an insufficient description in the modern world in the sense that it tended to obscure the close interrelationship between these two states and the fact that they ultimately highlight two very important realities. So, in addition to looking specifically at Church teaching in regard to fertility and the interrelationship between the unitive and procreative dimensions of sexuality, we will also note in this section how the Church has begun to articulate more fully the understanding of the close interrelationship between the states of consecrated celibacy on the one hand and marriage on the other, so that the language of superior and inferior begins to give way to a more fruitful discussion of the absolute necessity of each for the other. And that applies in both these dimensions. That is, the question of the unitive and procreative dimensions of sexuality and the state of marriage on the one hand and the state of consecrated virginity on the other. I should mention parenthetically that I'll use the terms consecrated virginity, consecrated celibacy, and vowed life without considering their detailed canonical significance. I'll be using them essentially as equivalents. Particularly in the early Church, the notion of consecrated virginity did not refer specifically to an intact state, but to the promise of abstention from sexuality, which created a new state and a new context for one's life in the life of the vows. As we will see, there is a close relationship not only between the components of these two areas, but between these two areas themselves, sexuality on the one hand, and the understanding of the symbolic significance of both marriage and consecrated celibacy on the other. Both highlight important eschatological and bioethical moral values, and each is necessary for the well-being and the proper understanding and indeed the existence of the other. So we'll look at foundational texts and note how the Church's language has developed over the last century or so, culminating in the theology of the body of John Paul II, which has only just really begun to be explored and to be explicated in a wider, broader sense for the general Catholic population. We'll also note the fact that John Paul's theology of the body is firmly based on the insights of his predecessor Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, which is itself an explication of and a deepening of doctrine that one finds clearly expressed at Vatican II in the text of Gaudium et Spes, which we'll be looking at a little later in this section. So we'll begin with three early statements, two of them magisterial, the encyclical Arcanum Divinae Sapientiae, the first real papal encyclical on the subject of Christian marriage, which was issued by Pope Leo XIII in 1880, the second document being Casti Connubii, another papal encyclical on the subject of marriage, which we've already looked at in part earlier in this course. That was by Pope Pius in 1930. And then the third source, which is not strictly magisterial, that is, it isn't official church teaching or a church teaching document, was nonetheless important from the standpoint of catechesis, and it reflects the way in which church teaching was popularly taught up until the Second Vatican Council, and that is the Baltimore Catechism in its form in which it was published in 1963. So we'll take a look now at elements of each of these three documents, beginning with Pope Leo XIII's encyclical on marriage, Arcanum Divinae Sapientiae, the ancient divine wisdom, which is the way that this encyclical actually begins. The encyclical, as I've mentioned in the text that precedes it, was particularly occasioned by the Pope's concern to express his objection to the notion of civil marriage and to the intrusion of the state into what, at least in Western Europe, following the French Revolution, had been felt to be the responsibility and the right of the Church to define and regulate marriage. So he does have a very specific project in this encyclical, but in the course of expressing these concerns, he also does the first really foundational work from the perspective of a papal encyclical. There had, of course, been statements concerning marriage, its sacramentality, and some aspects of its nature already in the Middle Ages and then at the Council of Trent. But what one finds here is a gathering together of those traditions in language that will then become standardized in subsequent texts. And I have only cited five sections, paragraphs or parts of this document, beginning with number five. He speaks of the union of man and woman that is the result of not just a human effort, or if you will, a human or natural sacrament, which on one level it is. Pope John Paul II particularly highlights that it is, as he put it, the only sacrament that predates the fall, the only sacrament that comes to us from our unfallen state. But that's not the point that Leo XIII is making. He points out that this union, which is intended by God, has two excellent properties, and he is here borrowing from, drawing particularly from St. Augustine. It has within it the properties of unity and perpetuity, that it draws together two individuals, and that it is intended to last for a lifetime. And if you drop down, and I should mention that I have added these little numberings that are in brackets. Whenever you see numbers that are in brackets and in red, I've added that for the sake of clarity. It doesn't exist in the original text. It's to highlight the ordering of the particular statements that are being made. If we drop down to the next bit of highlighted text, the Pope emphasizes that marriage should exist between only two persons, so polygamy is ruled out, and between one man and one woman. So again, a statement of interest and importance for us today in regard to the controversy concerning same-sex marriage. And then he also points out that the marriage bond is by the will of God, so closely and strongly made that it cannot be dissolved by any earthly authority. and he quotes the famous biblical text on this from the mouth of our Lord, that what God has joined together, no person, no human being may put asunder. Then, if we go down to number 10, and here too, the text that is in white against a blue background represents my own highlighting of particular concepts. It's not found in the original text. There is here a distinction between a first and a second purpose of marriage. He says Christian perfection and the completeness of marriage are not compromised on points which he has previously mentioned. For first of all, he says, there has been vouchsafed to the marriage union a higher and nobler purpose than was ever previously given to it. By the command of Christ, it looks not only to the propagation of the human race, but the bringing forth of children for the church. So the first purpose of marriage is propagation of the race and, in the Christian context, bringing forth new Christians into the world. So the so-called procreative function is here listed and highlighted as being first. And second, he says, are the mutual duties of husband and wife. And I've described this as the union and communion of the couple. He particularly says that this is the obligation to be bound to have such feelings for one another as to cherish always great mutual love, to be ever faithful, and to give one another an unfailing and unselfish help. This notion of a bilateral giving and sharing of each other will be foundational for later papal descriptions and will be incorporated into John Paul II's theology of the body, as we shall see. Then in number 26, he speaks again of the end or the purpose or the goal of the divine institution of marriage, and he describes in general terms that it's intended to be a source of benefit and a public welfare, not only instituted for, and this number one, again, the numbers are my own additions, but he lists first the propagation of the human race, the procreative function, and also, or but also, the lives of husbands and wives, that they might be made better and happier. And he lists in the next sentence the means by which their lives are improved, by lightening each other's burdens, by constant and faithful love, by having possessions in common, and by the fact that this is a sacramental relationship, one particularly blessed by God and elevated to the dignity of a sacrament. So what we see here in Arcanum, in this early text on Christian marriage, is a description of multiple functions of marriage, but whenever the functions of procreation and union are mentioned, the ordering is that procreation or propagation of the race is listed first. And then if we move down to number two, Pope Pius' encyclical Casti Connubii, which we have already looked at, particularly in the context of the eugenics controversy, which was an issue that he was very specifically intending to address. I've chosen here a couple of texts that we've seen before, but ones which are of particular importance for this subject of the interrelationship between these two ends or purposes of marriage. And we find here, in a number of places, an emphasis on the chief or primary end of marriage, that is to say, the primary purpose of human sexuality being, in this text, the begetting of children. The procreative element is strongly emphasized, but not exclusively. If we look at number 7, he speaks of the souls of the contracting parties that are joined and knit together more directly, more intimately than are their bodies, not by a passing affection of a sense of spirit, but by a deliberate and firm act of the will. So this union between husband and wife is more than just the sexual union for the purpose of creating children. It's also for mutual support. But having said that, it's pretty clear if you look now at number 8, and he's quoting another text of Leo XIII, other than Arcanum here, that to take away the natural and primeval right of marriage to circumscribe in any way the, and here he describes them as the principal ends of marriage, the principal ends of marriage, laid down in the beginning by God himself in the words, increase and multiply, is beyond the power of any human law. So he is carrying on what was hinted at in our conum, that the primary end of marriage, or what he describes as the principal end of marriage, is to fulfill the command increase and multiply. If we then look down at number 10, he is here referring back to St. Augustine, and this is a text that we've looked at very briefly, and the three traditional goods of marriage, which St. Augustine mentions, are proles, fides, and sacramentum, that is to say, children or offspring, proles, conjugal faith, fides, and the sacrament, sacramentum. This is the ordering that one finds in Augustine, but in Augustine's own discussion of them, he doesn't necessarily maintain the ordering. That is, Augustine is not himself emphasizing a primary or secondary end, and so in the text that's lightly highlighted in yellow, you'll see that the first thing that's dealt with is actually fides, faith, and then proles, offspring, and then finally sacramentum. But in number 11, the statement is made, thus among the blessings of marriage, and this is a text that will be quoted quite regularly in subsequent documents, bona locum tenet proles. The child or offspring holds the first place. So it is the primary blessing of marriage and is thereby understood as being the primary goal of marriage. So he emphasizes in number 13 that this is not just a question of having children, but also being willing to educate them. That is, take and create a family in which children can be raised who, as we already saw in our conum, are members of the Church of Christ. And here again in number 53, he says that, and here he's talking, speaking specifically against the practice of contraception, first consideration, primum de prole, first consideration is a concern for, is concerning the offspring, concerning the children. And then finally, number 54, he says that the conjugal act is destined primarily by nature, or an alternate translation of that text would be, is by its very nature destined for the begetting of children. This conviction, this sense of multiple aspects of or meanings of marriage and multiple meanings of the sexual act with reproduction, with the production of children being the primary or most significant, becomes a kind of a byword. It's incorporated into the canon law at an early point, or at least it tends to be reiterated there. And as we'll see, it's very intriguing that in the new code of canon law, which is cited in the Catechism of the Church, the ordering is actually changed. And this is not to say that the Church is changing its teaching, that you know one or the other is actually more significant as contrasted with what was said in the past. Rather, what becomes clearer in subsequent documents is that it's not a question, and it should not be from the standpoint of catechesis, a question of primarily emphasizing one or the other meaning, but of holding the two together, of holding them in a dynamic relationship so that one can see that ideally the two are always together and that the fault consists in trying to have one without the other. That is, in the case of assisted reproduction, to have the good of offspring without the union, which is proper to sexual intercourse, or in the case of contraception, to have the act of union without any intention of or with the intention of deliberately forbidding or making impossible productive or aspect of fecundity in marriage. So the emphasis will be not just in determining which is primary, but in pointing out how they are interrelated and how they always need to be seen in conjunction with one another. But it's good for us to be aware of this background in which the reproductive end tended to be emphasized more, because if we read literature from the early part or the middle part of the 20th century, one will find that stress, that particular emphasis. Now, I've included the New St. Joseph Baltimore Catechism, not just for a kind of a sense of, you know, delight or comic relief, although it is kind of amusing sometimes to note the ways in which the faith was imparted in the past. Again, not that this is inappropriate, not that we're trying to make fun of something which does contain very valuable teaching, but because it helps us understand why the Church felt the need to expand its approach. And if we look down And number 197, this is the section on the vows, on the evangelical counsels. What does our Savior especially recommend that is not strictly commanded? He especially recommends the observance of the evangelical counsels, poverty, chastity, and obedience. And so then there's a description of the vocation to the religious life. The text in red is the commentary that was added to the original text of the Baltimore Catechism, but it was very important. It was used. It was the way in which the material was taught. And one does find a very strong emphasis on religious life as the highest way, the way that should be primarily encouraged, with marriage being regarded as secondary. One finds that in the section under vocations that's highlighted, Come Follow Me. Notice that after describing the vows, and I've highlighted this text in white, the commentary says, these vows consecrate them, the individuals who take them, and give them the best possible helps to reach perfect love of Christ. So it is the vows of religious life that enable one to have the best possible means of reaching the perfect love of Christ. If you go on then and drop down a little bit further after a description of priests, brothers, and sisters, there is a kind of a clarification that the comparison between religious life and secular life is not a comparison between good and evil, but between good and better. So religious life is better than whatever could be lived out in secular life. And then under poverty, there's this little picture of children who want various kinds of things, and St. Francis, who wants simply to give everything away for the love of God. This is better than living in the world. In regard to chastity, and this is something that will be especially highlighted or brought forward, I should say, and nuanced in a much more effective way in the theology of the body, this contrast with a nuptial mass where the couple is being married as Catholics in the church, this is good, but a sister making her final vows, choosing Christ as her spouse, this is better in regard to chastity. And there's a particular highlighting in this text, and I've highlighted it in white, an emphasis on virginity and celibacy, which is superior to the married state. Now, again, without saying that the church is changing its teaching, the danger of simply stating that is that it does not highlight the unique and beautiful sacramentality of marriage and the way in which marriage itself powerfully proclaims the love of the Blessed Trinity. And that will be the task of later statements on marriage, to highlight the significance of marriage so that it doesn't seem inferior, even if the language of secondary tends to be used. And in regard to the question of obedience here too, the ordinary obedience of a family is depicted as less than the obedience of a couple of brothers who have consecrated themselves in religious life. Now, also clear in regard to the Church's teaching on marriage, and a little problematic, is number 467, what should Catholics do to prepare for a holy and happy marriage? To pray, seek the advice of parents and confessors, practice the virtues, frequently receive the sacraments. All of this is excellent. But then in the commentary, there are three signs of a marriage vocation. And number one is absence of a religious vocation. That is, you can't consider marriage unless you're sure you aren't choosing the higher way, and that's effectively what is said. If you look at the last sentence in this highlighted text, they, that is a married couple, should not prepare for marriage until they are sure God does not have even greater plans for them. And again, without denigrating this approach, one has to recognize that it is rather one-sided, and it does need to be enhanced. The dignity and power and significance of the sacrament of matrimony needs to be highlighted, and indeed, one needs to bear in mind that the vowed life is not a sacrament in the Catholic Church. Marriage is. The vows of a monk or of a brother or of a nun are not sacraments. They are vows, but not they do not consecrate the life in the same sacramental way that marriage does. Now, ordination is a sacrament, but the vow of celibacy attached to ordination is not part of its essence. Again, it is a required discipline in the Western Church, and a very necessary and proper one, but one needs to bear in mind that it is not of the essence, for example, of diaconate or priesthood, since in the Eastern churches, in the Eastern Rite churches, in the Catholic Church, and in the Orthodox churches, deacons and married and priests are overwhelmingly married. Bishops are not. They're expected to live lives of consecrated celibacy. But all of that is by way of saying that one can already sense, even in this kind of a teaching, an opening out, if one were to look, say, at the question of sacramentality, of a way of highlighting in a way that had not been done the beauty and the value of marriage, and thus the positive significance of the ends of marriage, which we've seen articulated in a partial way in these first two papal encyclicals. And we'll move on now to the texts of Vatican II, Gaudium et Spes, on the question of marriage.